I'm Peter Solomon. You're listening to Jazz 88. It's no overstatement to call Bill Charlap one of the leading pianists of his generation. Since the 1980s, he's worked with a long list of iconic jazz artists. He got his start recording for Jerry Mulligan. He worked in Phil Wood's quintet. He's accompanied Tony Bennett, Dede Bridgewater, and many, many others. Charlap is appearing at the Dakota with a trio including bassist David Wong and drummer Kenny Washington on March 22nd. I spoke to him recently and asked him to talk about his musical roots. His parents were both well-known musicians. His father, Moose Charlap, wrote the songs for Peter Pan, and his mother, Sandy Stewart, is a Grammy-nominated singer. He recalls major songwriters like Kip Harburg, Marilyn and Alan Bergman, and Charles Strauss visiting his home when he was growing up, although he says he didn't know who they were or why they were important at the time. He says it was his older sibling who initially turned him on to jazz.
My brother, Tom Charlap, about 10 years older than me. He's a wonderful bass player. And hearing him play and some records that he bought me of George Shearing and Joe Zawinul and records in my parents' collection, Ahmad Jamal, Oscar Peterson, Bill Evans, Clark Terry, Bob Brookmeyer, Sarah Vaughan, things like that piqued my interest. I just heard the music, you know, and it spoke to me. And some other things also. One of my first gigs was working at a place called the First Amendment Theater and Improv Company. It was sort of an actor studio approach to improvisation, like Whose Line Is It Anyway? I was like a silent movie pianist. And there was a wonderful actor there who loved jazz and made some cassettes for me. For those of you who don't know what those are in our younger audience, he made me playlists, and on those playlists, it would say something like Lou Donaldson and MJQ and Give the Year, or Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers, Miles Davis Nonet, Jerry Mulligan Tentet, one tune from each of these people, but he had perfect taste. He really took me on a journey of some of the greatest classic performances. Each one of those cuts, you know, if I heard Room 608, well, I was being introduced to Horace Silver, Doug Watkins, Art Blakey, Hank Mobley, and Kenny Dorham. Knowing who those names were now, they were like little seeds. And those seeds told me, you better listen to everything of Kenny Dorham or everything of Doug Watkins, everything of Art Blakey. So it became like all these tributaries to the great river, in a way. That was really important to me. God bless Ash Harlan. That was his name. I don't know what he's doing now. You never know who you're going to touch and how you're going to touch them. He helped me a great deal.
So the trio you've worked with for a long time, although it's not exactly the group you're going to be playing with in Minnesota, consists of bassist Peter Washington and drummer Kenny Washington. I remember seeing them a few times at the Village Vanguard with Tommy Flanagan, and I know they had a long association with him. And I was wondering if there was any relationship between you and Tommy Flanagan or how you came to start working with those gentlemen.
Well, firstly, I should clarify that Kenny Washington worked with Tommy Flanagan with George Mraz. Band was Kenny Washington and George Mraz, and then subsequently, the band was Peter Washington and Lewis Nash. Tommy Flanagan, well, he's one of the ultimate heroes to me, a profoundly brilliant pianist, equal in stature to Bill Evans, Bud Powell. All the giants. He's one of the great giants of all time, a true poet of the piano and a true original. And of course, I listened to Tommy's trio many, many times, live and of course on record. He was a hero of mine and I got to know him peripherally, but I was just a kid and, you know, I wasn't going to come on strong with someone like that. He got to know me at one point and I couldn't believe it one night when the trio was playing together. I looked in the audience and there was Tommy sitting right behind me. So that put the heat on me. I did the best that I could. I was terrified. I think the next night I came in feeling, okay, I can relax now. But I turned around and George Shearing was sitting there. So this is how you make your reputation. And I know, I understand that it's a huge compliment that they should have come and been there. But believe me, I was very intimidated, but I did my best to get to the center of what I was doing. As far as Kenny and Peter are concerned, I was aware of both of their work, of course, with Tommy, but many other things. Kenny Washington's work with other people, such as people who are more contemporaries of mine, like Michael Weiss and Mike LaDon, and of course, people like Milt Jackson and Dizzy Gillespie and other people like that. The same for Peter, who had played with Art Blakey and so many of the great people. And they were also almost a house rhythm section for Crisscross Jazz, which is a Dutch label based in Enschede. The producer of those records was a man called Jerry Teekens. And Jerry modeled himself in a way on the great Blue Note records. What he would do is he was interested in whoever were the voices in New York mostly. It started with grandmasters, people like Kenny Barron and Warren Marsh and Tom Harrell, but went on to include all of my contemporaries, Brad Meldow, Mark Turner, Chris Potter, Reenie Rosnes. All of these people were recording for the label. And I made some records with my dear friend and great musician, John Gordon. And so Jerry got to know me, and I made a few records with, firstly, with Dennis McCrell and Scott Colley. Secondly, with Bill Stewart and Sean Smith. And then the third record that I made for Crisscross as a leader, I said to Jerry Teekens, I'd like to make a record with Kenny Washington and Peter Washington. Now, understand that they were like the house rhythm section, almost like Art Taylor and Paul Chambers were to Prestige. And Jerry said to me, what do you want to do that for? They record with everyone, because he wanted it to be unique. And I said, well, I have a feeling about the chemistry. First of all, I loved their chemistry together. And I had a feeling that we might have a good chemistry, which was even better than I imagined. So here we are almost 30 years later and still playing together.
Can you talk about a little bit about your most recent recording that features that combo, And Then Again?
Well, the Village Vanguard has been home to us and, of course, is the premier jazz club in the world for so many reasons. One of them is its commitment to excellence and to listening and to the players who are the most themselves, always championing people with original voices in the music. And of course, the history from Bill Evans to Miles Davis to Oscar Peterson to even an earlier history where you had people like the Reviewers. Which was a cabaret team of sorts, which consisted of people like Leonard Bernstein and Judy Holliday and Betty Comden and Adolph Green and comedians like Professor Irwin Corey.
Why does a chicken cross the road?
Well, actually, it's not a chicken. It's a rooster that's looking for a chicken.
The Vanguard is New York City, and it hasn't changed. It is still the same after 80 years, 90 years now. But it's not the Village Vanguard Museum. it's still 100% vital. And there's another thing that happens in that club, which is because of the magic of the stage, the way the stage is set, the shape of the room, the sound in the room, it's perfect, both for the audience and even more importantly for the musicians on the bandstand. So even though the drums may be stage left and I'm all the way stage right, I'm hearing the hi-hat right in my left ear, even though it's way all over there. Things like that, they create the possibility of the best performance. That's why it's like Carnegie Hall. Sounds great on stage in Carnegie Hall. Sounds great on stage at the Village Vanguard. So, that's a snapshot of one of our sets. I think it's mostly the second set from Saturday night from a couple of years ago, though I think there's a few tunes from the first set on there. And just an idea of what we were doing at that time in terms of extemporaneous playing and spontaneity, and I think it captures us well in mid-flight, and that's what that record is all about. It's the second live record we've done. The first was about 20 years ago, and it's called Live at the Village Vanguard, so we couldn't call it that again.
I wanted to ask you about your spouse, too. You've been married for some time now to the wonderful Canadian piano player Renee Rosnes, and you've made recordings with her. Has she inspired you to explore new musical spaces? Do you influence each other?
Yes, we certainly do. Renee's a genius. She's a brilliant pianist, a brilliant improviser. Just her pedigree speaks for itself. She has been the side person by their hiring and by their demand of people like Joe Henderson, Wayne Shorter, J.J. Johnson, Bobby Hutcherson, James Moody, Ron Carter. I mean, you really can't get higher than that. That tells you the esteem that she's held in. And as a leader, as a composer, as a pianist, she's a vital force in the music. So playing duets with her is always lifting and enlightening. And we have a great simpatico together that was always there musically, a great chemistry. It has to do with the fact that we feel the time in a similar place, though not exactly the same. So it complements each other. We have a commitment to making a sound at the piano, touch, time, harmony, music first. It's not a piano duel, it's a piano duo. And the chemistry was always there. We always think in terms of the whole being greater than its parts. Double Portrait, because it's 50-50. And in terms of learning from Rainey, absolutely. I've gleaned so much. I mean, besides that she's the love of my life and my life's partner, I have immense respect for her musicianship. And naturally, we've influenced each other.
Are there any exciting new projects on the horizon in 2025?
Well, yes. It's not brand new because we've been doing this for a little while now, but Dee Dee Bridgewater and I have a duo, and we started doing that right before COVID. We had a whole lot of things booked, and then of course COVID set in and everything got canceled like the rest of the world did. But as we all rose from the ashes of that, we've been playing all over the world, and we made a recording a short while ago, which has the extemporaneous quality that happens when we get together.
That is what this is. Old Bill and I talk and talk and talk. I mean, you're just about to experience it. I never get much for moonlit skies. Never wink back at fireflies. Now that the stars are in your eyes, Bill, I see the light. I never went in for...
And that's going to be coming out, I believe, this spring. It's called Elemental.
Is there anything else you want to say before your gig coming up at the Dakota?
Well, I love the Dakota, and I love Minneapolis, and I love the audiences there. And we've played there over the years many, many times. I remember playing at the Dakota when it was in its original place with Kenny and Peter and with Phil Woods as our guest. So I remember that being the first time playing at the Dakota, and it's always been a wonderful experience, and the audiences there are elegant, thoughtful, great listening audiences, and I love the club.
Bill Charlap will be playing two shows at the Dakota on March 22nd, along with David Wong on bass and drummer Kenny Washington. Bill, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
So nice to speak with you, Peter. Thanks for everything.